very first Talking Tales. We're all very excited. Tonight is hosted by Scopecroft writers, who are dotted around the room. It's taken us a little bit to get here. There's been tears, hysterics, an almost punch up, and I'm not joking, don't mess with Steph. we are a group of flash fiction, short story, novella, novels, everything, and anywhere in between. We write about zombies, horror, humour, everything. We've been together about 2 years, and yes, this is our inaugural event, so yes, we're very excited. We put it on really to showcase the talent around Bristol, and we've got some really great performers coming on tonight, but also what we really want to get across is that it's not about people standing up here and performing for you. Writing is for everybody, and we want you to share in our joy of writing. So on your table is a little worksheet, because that's the kind of girl I am. And what we'd like you to do is finish the lines in any way you want. By yourself, in a group, in a pair. Finish it in any way you like, as long as you're in the boundaries of moral decency. Would be good. At the end, we're going to pick our favourites and read them out, and then they'll also feature on our website. So have fun with that. I don't want to make sure I don't forget anything. Oh, podcast. We're doing a podcast tonight. Max, our lovely sound guy, is helping us out, and he's working for free. So if you want to make a donation to the sound guy, that would be very much appreciated, so he can buy water and gruel, I presume. I'll put the cup around somewhere. If for all the performers that we've got on tonight, there's a set list on all the tables. I've been informed that the squiggly yellow line is a little unseeable, but there is one there. So to all performers, please talk into the microphone, or Chris will be forcing your face into it, which no one wants to experience or witness. Please do. In the spirit of I wouldn't ask anyone to do what I wouldn't do myself, I'm first up. I did start to draw up a list of things that I wouldn't do. I didn't get very far. All I came up with was that I wouldn't be alone in a room with Al Pacino or Noel Edmonds. Alone or separately. Anyway, this is a little short story from me. It's called How to Live in a Lift. Derek adjusted his little red hat as the lift doors opened on the ground floor. He stepped to the side to welcome the three people always waiting at 5:30 p.m. They shuffled forward, not looking at each other, not looking at him. He nodded at them, one by one. The tall man with tight curly red hair who walked with hunched shoulders, his head down, floor two. Derek pressed the button. The short, chubby Asian woman with glasses that were too big for her face and headphones that were never off her ears, floor seven. And the middle-aged woman with thinning hair and wheezing breath, who was covered in gold costume jewellery, floor five. Derek checked his uniform, combed the remaining strands of hair sideways over his head, and leaned over to smell the hair of the middle-aged woman in a sniff that made his eyelids flutter. Then the doors closed, and the small metal block ascended. Kenny couldn't talk to her. She was too beautiful. The lift doors closed, and Kenny stifled a sigh. He hated this lift, feeling oversized with his head almost touching the ceiling, but he couldn't bear to miss an opportunity to be near her. He looked down at Wendy's dark hair and wondered what she was listening to on those headphones she never seemed to take off. Something cool from a band he'd never heard of, he supposed. There was so little he knew about her. What she ate for dinner, how long it took her to tie her shoelaces, how many spoons she had. But he did know that he loved her and wanted to spend the rest of her life in her apartment watching her sleep. Wendy adjusted her headphones. How to get noticed and stay ahead, chapter one. In order to get ahead, you need to get noticed. Therefore, the first step in getting ahead is getting noticed. Wendy turned her head just slightly, straining her eyes first left. The lift attendant was looking not at her, but the woman in front of her. And then to her right was only the tall man's shoulders. No one had noticed her. Chapter 1, Part 1, Getting Noticed. The most important part of getting noticed is... Wendy turned up the volume. Glenda stood staring at her reflection in the lift doors, at the tight skirt and the high backcomb hair, and thought she looked ridiculous. Who was she trying to fool? Her, just an old fool. No man would ever want her again, not with the thin hair and sad face looking back at her. Glenda stood face forward, refusing to let anyone else see her trying not to cry. Derek was in love again. He'd seen her yesterday for the first time, her fake jewels shining, and his heart had stuttered. It was either love or the arrhythmia was back again. Derek checked the tassels on her shoulder pads, on his shoulder pads were tangled, and tugged the jacket together over his ample belly. The aroma of her hair made his thighs shake, and he wondered if this mysterious beauty would be happy with a spring wedding or would prefer to wait until summer. The lift shuddered to a stop and the doors opened. Floor 2, Derek said in his special voice, leaning towards the woman. The one that implied, I'll rescue you from a burning building, but also I'll cry when all our babies are born. She stood staring ahead, ignoring him completely, and his heart raced. He chewed his bottom lip and stared pointedly at the tall man who lived on floor 2. The tall, red-headed man looked down at the short girl, opening his mouth as if to speak, but just sighed and got out of the lift. Wendy watched the lift doors closed on the tall, handsome man and didn't know why she thought he'd notice her. He was way out of her league. She listened to the lift attendant's heavy breathing for a moment as the lift slowed to a stop again before starting the audiobook and concentrating hard on the words. As the door opened on the 5th floor, Derek watched the object of his desire get off without a cursory glance in his direction. He wanted to shout after her, cry for her not to leave him, promise her the world and not rest until she got it. Instead, he took quietly in the lift and pressed the button to close the doors. 2. Much later, it was dark outside. Kenny pressed the button for the lift. It arrived with a soft chime and the doors opened with a gentle whoosh. Kenny just stood there, looking in. Something strange had happened inside. Instead of the normal-looking lift, 3 blue carpeted walls in an open space, there were 2 walls, one on either side, and now a bed in the middle. Duvet, pillow, and a sleeping bump. Kenny coughed and the lift attendant sat up, his hair ruffled from sleep. Hello, he said, putting his glasses on and reaching over to hold the door open button. Hello, Kenny said, crouching slightly, the height difference even more pronounced with the man lying down. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to disturb you. Derek nodded and asked, where are you going so late? Nowhere, really, Derek chuckled and nodded as if this was perfectly acceptable. Well, you better come in, Derek said, waving a hand towards the end of the bed. My finger's killing me. Derek looked at the white tip of Derek's finger, still pressed on the button. Oh, right, sorry. Kenny stepped inside and stood with his shoulders hunched and his head down for a moment before sitting down on the edge of his bed, his knees up around his face. There was a moment of silence as the two men nodded at each other. Do you sleep here every night? Kenny said, for something to say. I live here, Derek said, with a smile, gesturing around as if it was a castle instead of a lift. Do they make you? Make me? No. In fact, they don't even know. Derek giggled like a child, his shoulders shaking with a grin fixed on his chubby face. I fitted the bed myself, and you're the first to catch me. He clapped his hands, pleased. Kenny frowned, considered just letting it go, but he didn't know how to continue the conversation without asking, why? Derek's smile wavered for a moment, before returning as bright and strong. Well, why not, I asked. Life offers you up these opportunities and you have to take them, right? So Sandra kicks me out. That's the universe telling me it's time to make a change. And I thought to myself, Derek, you like people? You like the lift? So here I am, for better or worse, as it were. Kenny nodded, having no idea what this little man was talking about. So, shall we go up? Perhaps to floor 7 and a certain Asian lady? On the way we will talk of love, my friend. Yes, of love lost, of love won, but always of glorious love. Kenny looked confused, but stayed hunched on the end of the bed, and let Derek press the glowing number 7. The doors opened on a silent 7th floor. Kenny didn't know what he'd been expected. Heard to be standing there waiting for him at 2 a.m. He sighed and shrugged at the same time when Derek clapped him on the back. "Son, you'll never understand women, so don't bother to try. The mystery is part of the fun," he said. Kenny turned and was distracted from Derek's words by the further transformation within the lift. Small little fold-down shelves had opened out all over the walls on either side of the bed. Custom-made, Kenny presumed. On each shelf was a clutter of little objects. Derek held up a pair of tights, the bottoms oddly misshapen. Myrtle. March 1983. She had the most marvellous calves. Calves that would make a grown man cry, "God, I love that woman." But for some reason, it didn't last long. Next was a small sugar bowl, complete with its own little spoon. Pamela. September 1983. She made the best cup of tea I've ever tasted, that woman. I fell in love with her at a church fete. Didn't last long, though. I'm not sure why. Kenny pointed at a built-up shoe on a shelf near his head. What about this? Ah, Susan. 1984, what a woman. She had one leg shorter than the other and a walk that drove me wild. God, I loved her. I really loved her. Did it last long? No, it didn't. But the thing is, I tried. I loved all these women, he said, gesturing at the collection that included a yellowing tooth, a lock of thinning brown hair, a rubber duck, a snow globe of Weston-super-Mare, and on around the walls. I loved every single one of them, he said, as he stroked the built-up shoe. And I'll love again soon. You should try it. Kenny looked startled, not comfortable in the spotlight. Well, I don't know about that. I always think waiting is a good tactic. Nothing like a good wait and see. Or perhaps let things run their course. That's a good one. Kenny was nodding, expecting his hands, the ceiling, the material of the duvet, anywhere but Derek's eager face. Madness! Madness, I say. No, love has to be chased, savoured, and then chased again. I mean, it's mainly about the chase for me, but others enjoy the savouring. Just don't dwell on the familiarity, boredom, then hatred part. That's the key. Derek slapped Kenny on the back. So, we should formulate a plan on how to win the heart of the glorious Wendy, yes? Derek's enthusiasm was almost infectious, especially in such close confines. And being a guest, Kenny found it difficult to disagree. So he nodded, and a plan was hatched in the early hours of the morning, surrounded by the mementos of romance. Part 3. The lift doors opened, and the morning sunlight reflected off Derek's watch. 8 a.m. Kenny stepped into the lift, which looked just like a normal lift again, and tried not to stare at Wendy. He edged round so he was facing her, looking down on her perfectly parted hair, getting in the right position to carry out the plan. The doors closed, and the lift descended. Wendy adjusted her headphones and stared straight ahead. She had the feeling she was being looked at, but couldn't imagine that was true, so didn't bother to look. Instead, she focused on rehearsing what she'd say to the next person that spoke to her. Derek was staring as well. The aroma from the woman from floor 5 had him by the throat, and he was finding it difficult to swallow. He stared at the balding spot on the back of her head and thought he'd be happy to look at it forever. The tears in Glenda's eyes were from anger this time, as she remembered answering the door to her husband with a smug look on his face. Her in her dressing gown with her thin hair just washed and flat against her scalp. Him with his new girlfriend behind him, her hair full and thick. She crossed her arms and resolved to never speak to another man as long as she lived. The lift began to slow, and the G lit up above the heads of the group. Derek dragged his eyes away from the woman's plump, ring-covered fingers and gave Kenny a pointed look. It was now or never for the plan. Kenny opened his mouth as the lift doors opened. Wendy looked up at him and smiled, and his breath was taken. Derek watched, holding his breath. This was it. The moment stretched to breaking point, and then it passed, leaving Kenny just standing there with his mouth open. Wendy stepped out of the lift and walked away, muttering welcoming pleasantries under her breath, looking for someone to talk to. Kenny stared after her. Derek stared at him. The woman from floor 5 stared at them both. Jesus, Kenny, the plan was perfectly simple, Derek said. Say hello. It was rock solid plan. What happened? I don't know. I just felt perhaps a little bit more wait and see was necessary. Kenny sighed. Derek clapped him on the back. Oh well, we can try again tomorrow. Kenny nodded and stepped into the foyer. Derek turned to Glenda and his breath quivered. I think I love you, he said. Do you want to live in my lift with me? All right, she said, thinking this would be definitely the last man she ever spoke to. Kenny sighed, thinking love was too complicated for him, and set off to follow Wendy to work. Thank you. Next up is Kevlin Henney with On Taking Measures to Eliminate Fair Play. Kevlin is a local writer who writes short stories and flash fiction that has appeared online, on Tree and on Air. He also organises the Bristol Flash events on National Flash Fiction Day, which this year is Saturday, 27th of June, put that in your diaries, including a workshop at Bristol Central Library and an evening of readings at the Lansdowne. So a round of applause for Kevlin, please.
Right, oh yes, and all that's free, by the way, Flash Fiction Day. And there's an anthology. This story is taken from the anthology, but it's easier to read from a piece of A4. There'll be another anthology this year, if you write flash fiction. We're announcing it in a few weeks' time. Stories of up to 500 words, so stalk National Flash Fiction Day on Twitter. And this is the story I had last year in it, on taking measures to eliminate fair play. I'm delighted you could all join the meeting to plan the school fair. As you know, it has been a couple of years since the last one. We feel that the cloud, indeed storm, hanging over that event has now passed on, as has sadly Mrs. Pettigrew. Let us remember her for the many years of good work she put into this school and its pupils, and not let one or two episodes mar her memory. Rather, the increasingly laissez-faire approach of previous year's committees was to blame. The main lesson learnt is the need for greater guidance and supervision. A certain lack of vigilance in oversight, for example, led to oversights such as the professionally run tattoo store. At a not inconsiderable expense, particularly challenging without any fundraising events, I am happy to report that all operations to remove tattoos were completed before our decision to go ahead with this year's fair. We must be on our guard in ensuring that no innocent assumption is left without the strongest presumption of guilt. Such oversight and stricter guidance applies also to stands being run by the parents, especially where the benefit is for the parent body rather than the school or its pupils. Suspicions about the true nature of the bareback riding tent were raised only after someone noticed the lack of horses. It had been assumed up until that point that ponies were responsible for the noises. When this ride was proposed as being a boon to the swinging community of the school and that people would enjoy themselves, it is unlikely Mrs. Pettigrew was familiar with the full and colourful range of meanings embraced by the word swinging. We are fortunate that these particular activities were primarily confined to the tent and to adults, and certainly no one younger than sixth form. On this matter, the police were quite thorough. The clarification over wording is perhaps of even greater importance for the food stalls, whose relaxed aroma, alas, attracted all ages. It proves easy to confuse hash browns and hash brownies, a distinction that was new to many staff and parents. The revelation that space cakes were not some product of a Star Wars-themed bake-off offered similar insight and for some highlight. To reinstate the annual fair as a centrepiece of the school's calendar, we felt clean decks and new blood were needed to clean the decks of blood and other bodily fluids. Mrs. Pettigrew had been delighted that so many parents who were former pupils of the school had stepped up to the challenge, particularly those she remembered as having a difficult time when they were here. That such formerly disruptive elements would volunteer their time and energy to their alma mater and their own children's time was, she felt, a vindication of the transformative power of education. It also informed our decision to select you, the new committee, from the congregation of the local church. Now, moving forward, does anyone have any suggestions?
Star Wars themed bake-off sounds pretty brilliant to me. Next up is Lindsay Turner. Lindsay, writing as L.E. Turner, can be described as many things. Amongst them, a nerd, a feminist, an occasional performer, almost an archaeologist, a blogger, and a slightly surreal writer of urban fantasy, gothic horror, and science fiction. Should have taken a breath in that sentence. She is the author of Bristol set urban fantasy come gothic thriller About the Nature of the Creature. Round of applause for Lindsay, please.
I'm just really short, I'm sorry for the inconvenience. Hello everyone. I'm going to be reading a story that's actually based on a dream I had about some friends of mine. If that sounds creepy, it's because it possibly is. It's actually about some friends of mine who are burlesque performers, so hopefully not too creepy. What happens when the world comes to an end? The dead are walking around, stinking up the place, and all you've known is over. There isn't much use for your 60 words per minute or your excellent research skills. But if you happen to be drag queens and burlesque performers, perhaps you do have some skills that won't go to waste after the apocalypse. After all, everyone needs a bit of entertainment. This is the story I call The Joke Where the Golf Club Represents a Phallus. Lots of people complain all the time about how weird things are. It's so alien to me getting water from a well. I feel like I'm in a nightmare and I can't wake up. Can things get any weirder? The dead are walking around, for crying out loud. Thing is, apart from the undead walking around bit, my life was already a little weird by some people's standards. My good friends and colleagues were drag queens and strippers. We were always surrounded by laughing girls pretending their crystals were diamonds and their Lambrino was champagne. God, I miss Lambrini. There was always someone choking us up with glitter body spray, and hardly anyone ever remembered to bring tip tape. All of us had at least one routine related to our university degrees, and few of us wore safety thongs. Every day was a drama, every show a high. So actually, life didn't change all that much for us in the weird states. We still wanted to make people laugh, we wanted to move people. We wanted to do something that we'd always done. Celebrate sexuality, sensuality, body positivity, and joyous creative expression, as Miss Flem always said. So, you know, we did it. Everyone loved us. I remember this one time, we were holed up in this village for a good year and a half. We'd had to leave the city, as it was completely overrun with the corpses, and smaller places were safer, always fewer of those stinking buggers. It was such a nice place, really lovely people. They laughed when we arrived on our little bus. We were an absurdity beyond absurd. Feathers, thongs, Miss Flem's ridiculous platform shoes taking her to a good 7 foot tall. And then there was me, 5 foot nothing and previously rotund, now in the most ill-fitting clown-like clothes thanks to the enforced apocalyptic diet. Bourbon Street Betty's leather jacket had seen better days, and people were kind of creeped out by the small bones she had threaded through the left arm of it, trophies. Her corpse kills from when it all started. Strange how decorative an ulna can be. And of course, the beautiful kitty cat and baby blue turned heads immediately. We were a breath of the ridiculous through their dire lives, and that was before we even did anything, like, you know, perform. So our shows went over really well, just what the doctor ordered. Some of the locals helped us clear out the village hall. It was completely torn down at one end, and fenced it off real good, leaving the staging area outside, so people could crowd around. It was nice. We didn't charge much. Some people paid cash. Most paid with food, toothpaste, feminine hygiene products, stuff like that. They were considerate people. Our shows always drew them out, and it also drew out the corpses, which was actually a pretty good idea. They'd all be huddled there against the fence, so after the show we could just go out and smash their heads in. Productive and cathartic. The night I'm recalling now was the one with the golf clubs. We'd been there maybe a year. Some of the locals had even joined in doing skits and stuff. It wasn't just a travelling burlesque show anymore. We had musical recitals, book readings, comedy. Whatever the locals wanted to try their hands at, we had room on our bill. By this time, though, the car battery that we had our tinny, only one-speaker working boombox wired up to gave out. We thought of replacing it, but batteries were more of a priority for cars. So this local guy, insisting we call him Honky Tonk, dragged the piano from the back of the hall and set it up next to the stage. You haven't heard Awesome until you've heard the theme from True Blood played on the out-of-tune piano with 1/5 of the keys missing. Honky Tonk did love to play that tune. I was on the door that night, a mixed bag of making sure patrons dropped some payment into the box, whilst keeping the corpses from getting too close with a sharpened pool cue that came in handy for poking through their eyes. Bam, squish. The audience were filling the room about an hour before the show, grabbing the distilled nastiness that passed as hooch and finding the good seats, whilst Flem warmed them up with funny tales and a couple of show tunes. I was just basking in the glow of self-satisfaction after managing to get two stinkers right through the face in one punt. To be fair to them, the one in front was fairly decomposed, so it kind of just slid home. When Betty came up to grab me, "Leave that to Kitty," she said, grabbing the cue and pushing it into Kitty's waiting hands. "We've got a job to do." There was that grin on her face, which she usually gets when creating a new routine or killing corpses. I was a little worried. "Flem is going to do that golf club bit," she said, dragging me out the door. She slammed her knife into a couple of passing skulls as we made our way to the marketplace. Sun was near going down, so it would be closing up soon, and I kept watch for any trailing corpses whilst Betty perused the assortment of oddities at Friendly Jack's stall. A couple of machetes, but mostly weapons made of random objects, a whole rack of sharpened pool cues, and some polished cake tins intended as a projectile weapon. There was a golf club on a small rack, which Betty grabbed and looked over. "Meh," she commented, "it won't do." I saw what she meant. The club had the end removed and sharpened, so it wouldn't really look much like a golf club if you were at the back of the audience. It was an ex-golf club. "You got any real ones?" she asked Jack. Jack thought it over and went into the shed at the back of his store, finally dragging out a golf bag full of clubs. "Haven't converted these yet. There were maybe 6 clubs, all kinds. You know, big clubby ones, thin sort of ones. I don't know golf clubs." "Excellent, we'll take one," Betty told him. A really creepy wide smile spread across Jack's face. 200, he told us. Betty swore and glared at him. I raised an eyebrow. This man was always such a dick. "Okay, you can hire it, $150 an hour, unless..." He licked his lips as he trailed off. I shuddered. Creep. "Okay," Betty nodded. She had that grin she gets when she kills corpses. "Monkey, get yourself back to the show and tell Flem to go ahead. I'll be right there." Sometimes her grin scares me. I made my way back, blammoed a couple of corpses on the way. They were mostly all gathered to watch the show now that Honky Tonk had started to play. I got to the back of the hall and gave Flem the nod. The audience quieted down straight away as she started to address them. A drag queen, a stripper, and a priest go to the golf course. Betty arrived not a few minutes later, her arms loaded with golf clubs. "Here, hand these around." I took a really pretty one as far as golf clubs go and passed them on to Kitty and Baby. We made our way to the open end of the hall through the audience, that at this point was hooting with laughter. "So, Jack?" I asked Betty quietly. Her grin was wide and terrifying. "He'll live." Which he did, and he seemed considerably less creepy from then on. Never underestimate a badass stripper who knows how to use a knife better than you do. We got to the stage with perfect timing. I handed a club up to Flem just as she reached the end of her story. "And they're also great for killing corpses." The audience howled with laughter. We laughed too as we took our golf clubs and smashed the skulls of the closest corpses to the other side of the fence. Flem, with the height advantage of platforms and the stage, managed to swing and swipe the head clean off one whilst shouting, 4 fun times.
Thank you, Lindsay. I was just thinking that I don't miss Lab really, personally. That's just me. Yes. I always think also have a really unrealistic view that I would be incredible in an apocalypse, but I don't think that's true. Anyway, Pete Sutton is up next. Pete is a British Bristol writer and book blogger, one of the organisers of the Bristol Festival of Literature, a contributor to The Naked Guide to Bristol, contributing editor of Far Horizons magazine, and a founding member of North Bristol Writers. How do you have time for anything else, Pete? Who also have an event at Bristol Central Library on the 29th of April. Doors open 6:45. You got it in, Pete.
To book my book as well. Kevin's also in it, so if you enjoy our stuff tonight, see me and buy one. This is called The Witch's House, and it was written as from a prompt at the North Bristol Writers. I don't remember who suggested we play dares, but it was me who dared Paul to go to the witch's house, knock on the door, and run away. Paul showed no fear. He strolled, seemingly nonchalantly, up the path, to the house, and knocked on the door. He turned around to run, but the door opened straight away. It was dark in the hallway and light outside, so we couldn't see who opened the door. Perhaps it opened itself. We could see Paul talking, and then he went inside. The door closed behind him. We'd never have gone inside unless the witch cast a spell on him. Never. The rest of us wondered what we'd say to his parents when he didn't turn up for dinner. Stephen's lower lip trembled. It looked like he might cry. I was shitting myself. I did this. This is my fault. Bones, he said, we'd have to go and rescue him. None of the rest of us had thought that. None of us were that brave. Once he said it, though, we couldn't chicken out. We had to come up with a plan. We snuck behind into the forest, and we could see that the fence hadn't been maintained. It was pretty easy to move a few plants aside. We discussed what to do if the garden was full of poisonous plants or dangerous animals. Can't really remember what our plan was, but it involved sticks and using our jumpers to wrap around our hands. But in the end, we didn't need it. It looked like a fairly usual garden. Must be keeping up appearances, we said. One by one, we all went through the fence on our bellies. I half expected there to be a dog. I'd climbed into a big house's garden the summer before and been chased by an Alsatian. I'd badly sprained an ankle jumping over the wall to escape. I wasn't keen to repeat that. There wasn't a dog, though. We all had our sticks, and we ran out of crowds across the garden to the back door, which Stephen opened. That's probably the bravest thing I've ever seen him do. We crept into the kitchen. We could see the witch standing with her back to us, a low murmur coming from her. She must still be casting her beguiling spell on Paul, we thought. We hadn't planned this far ahead. We had no defence against their magic, and we were only armed with sticks. "Get her!" Barnsley cried. We charged, all yelling our heads off. Stephen ran to grab Paul, who was also shouting. The witch started shouting too. It was bedlam. I remember landing a corker of a shot on her face, seeing a spurt of blood spray across the wall. I felt pretty good right at that moment. Powerful. She fell to the floor, and we continued to pummel her. Paul tried to get us to stop, but he was compromised. He was under a spell. My arms ached, and when I eventually stopped, the palms of my hands were sore. "Run!" I shouted, and we all did. Paul hesitated, but Barnsley grabbed him and pulled him after us. When the police came to my door, my mum was pretty upset. I denied everything, of course, but it did no good. We'd been spotted, and Paul had blabbed. He said she'd only been a little old lady who wanted a chat and offered him cake. We all knew you don't take sweets from strangers. Paul said the old lady knew his mum, that she'd actually been to his house. We all knew, though, this was part of her disguise, a cunning spell she'd cast upon him. He hasn't come to visit me once. I don't know about the others. They split us up. It's pretty lonely here. The other boys are mean. I've been beaten up a couple of times. Apparently it's not what a gentleman does. Beat up old ladies, that is. She's still alive, though. I saw her in court. The journalist said we hung our heads in shame. I don't know about the others, but I just wanted to avoid her eyes. I didn't want her to cast a spell on me. Thank you.
Poor witches, so misunderstood. Next up we have Ellen Waddell. Ella Waddell is a writer, performer and filmmaker who's recently performed a one-woman show about Star Trek. It involved her talking to a papier-mâché head of Jean-Luc Picard for 50 minutes, and she's taking it, the show and the head, to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival this year. So a round of applause for Ellen.
Cabinet was filled with stuffed hummingbirds, their wings spread wide as if escape was imminent. I pushed my nose up against the glass and willed them to break free. Come on, you bastards, do something. Blink, do anything, squawk, don't be dead, move, don't be boring. I command you to live. I gave it 10 more seconds of fierce concentration before I gave up. Turns out I do not possess psychic powers and am not some kind of omnipotent god, something I suspected, but sometimes you have to check. I turned to B, my fastidious girlfriend, and poked her good-naturedly in the side. She was busy studying the information plaque explaining the migration patterns of the dead birds. It's a static zoo, I joked. She ignored me and carried on reading. Come on, I said, prodding her again, a little more desperately this time. Let's stare death in the face together and laugh. I pressed my face back up against the glass and waited for her to join me, but she didn't. I turned around just in time to see her grey hoodie disappear into a sea of busy tourists, swallowed by the waves of odd-looking families and tourists. You're dead and I'm not, ha ha, I sang the birds, a parting jest before I darted after her. I found her kneeling in front of a dead butterfly's flay, staring at a dead monarch butterfly, a pin through its meaty body. Are you having a lovely time? I asked jovially, attempting to inject some light into her dark mood. She responded with a tug which seemed to say, no I'm not, you total bastard. We wandered through the rest of the exhibition in total silence and I felt a tug of envy when I looked at the other visitors. Those delightfully odd-looking families glued together by sticky hands. Those heavily bonneted actors hoisting giant butterfly nets to the air. Those groups of European teenagers shoving each other with their backpacks. They were having fun and we were at war. I wanted to push the hair out of Bee's eyes, take her two square face in my hands and push my lips into her cheek and demand that she have fun with me. I wanted to push her against a cabinet and ask people if they could tell the difference between this piece of flesh and the decaying animal corpse inside the cabinet. I felt a sudden sharp pain in my shin. Fuck! I said involuntarily, looking down to see a wide-eyed schoolgirl in a mauve jumper hugging a clipboard. She had walked straight into my shin with a clipboard, and due to my sweary little outburst, people were now watching and shaking their heads at me. I had sworn at a child. Are you okay? I asked, ignoring the raw and instant pain in my leg. The schoolgirl shook her head and scampered off after the rest of the class. I turned to Bee, who was watching me, eyes narrowed and arms folded. You would love one of those, wouldn't you? She said angrily, pointing at the school children in their pick-and-mix uniforms. I sighed, said nothing. Here we go again. You would love one of those, she repeated angrily, pointing at three boys scribbling down the name of a giant dinosaur, sounding out the letters phonetically in a bid to get it right. Forgive me for wanting to have children with you, I replied. I wanted to have children and Bee didn't, and I suggested we visit the museum because I thought if she saw children learning, she might understand how great they are. If she glimpsed their young neurons making new synaptic connections and bore witness to their insatiable curiosity, she would then want to have a baby with me. It'd been a stupid idea. You can't even keep a plant alive. How would you even manage a child? She said, plonking herself down on a nearby bench. A child is a little different than a plant, I said, hurt by a reference to my failed plant collection. We fell into silence. My gaze fell on the European children. They were weary now. Their backpacks were full of postcards and books and jumpers, and they sat on the floor at the foot of the dinosaur. A security guard encouraged them to stand up, but they just laughed at him and his silly little life. I excused myself and went to the bathroom, needing the toilet and a break from all the resentment. I accepted long ago that my genes were not the best, but I thought hers were great. And as long as our kid didn't get my big ears or her hairy toes, my Roman nose or her eczema, my father's gambling addiction or her mother's nervous cough, then we would be laughing. I left the toilet prepared to apologise and lead her to the nearest bar, but she was already waiting outside, and she wasn't alone. Attached to her hand was a small, dark-haired boy in a grey school uniform, a kid with large green eyes and a runny nose. He couldn't have been any older than 8, and he seemed utterly content with his hand being clutched by Bee's. Is he lost? I asked Bee, confused and wondering with growing concern whether she had kidnapped him. Prove yourself, Bee said, ignoring my question and motioning her hand towards the eerily stoic child. Prove myself. I didn't understand. Did she want me to help him find his school group? I knelt down to talk to the boy. Where's the rest of your school? I asked as gently as possible. The boy shrugged and picked at the layer of crusty snot coating his right nostril. What's your name? I asked, trying a different tact. Jack, he said very quietly, and I detected a northern accent. And where's your teacher? I asked, but he went silent again and became fascinated with his feet. We'll help you find her, I promised, grabbing his left hand, which was damp with saliva, and although he said nothing in response, I'm sure I felt him squeeze my fingers. As I stood up, B grabbed the sleeve of my jumper, pulled me in and whispered in my ear, he says he has to be back in the main entrance by 5. Prove to me you can be a father. I looked at Jack, and he looked at me, and then he looked at his feet, and then he stuck one finger in his nostril, and I looked at her. Fine, I said, trying to convince myself that it was fine, that this science experiment, perfectly fitting for the location, was an acceptable way to test my parenting skills, and that if I passed, she would let me rest my sperm in her womb for about 9 months. We weren't doing anything terrible here, we weren't kidnapping him. Besides, the museum was calm, there were no screaming teachers or panicked security guards. No one was running around calling out, Jack, Jack, with tears running down their cheeks. No one was looking for him. In fact, you could argue it's better we had found him rather than some kind of museum pervert. We headed towards the interactive section of the museum, agreeing the other exhibitions might be a tad dry for a creatively minded child like Jack. And as we walked hand in hand, I began to ask him questions about his life, the whos, whats and the whys. I wasn't able to hold back because, to me, he was fascinating, with his snotty round face and his big unreadable eyes and his head full of dreams waiting to be fulfilled. But Jack did not answer me. He just looked around a lot. He was entranced with the general positioning of things, the sights around him, the curve of the banister, the tiles on the floor. He seemed happy to gawp and be led by us, but he didn't seem to want to actually talk to us. I wondered if this meant he was maybe a bit slow. But even if he was, I would still love him. And even if our child was mentally challenged, like Jack, then I would show him how to get on in life, encourage his creativity and nurture his poetic mind. Stare away, Jack, I would say. Stare away. I ruffled his hair and told him it was okay to be a bit quiet. Can I call you Connor, Jack, I asked. I don't know, he said. That's the name I've chosen, I said to Bea, who smiled wryly. She was having fun now, I could tell. She was swinging her hands and Jack was giggling every time she lifted his arms above his head. She would make a wonderful mother. We passed a display on the human body, a section on the healing process with cartoon scabs knitting themselves around a wounded knee. Connor fingered the raised blood cells and I leant over and explained this is how the body fixes itself. He continued to prod the blood cells, his fingers circling the membrane and tapping the nucleus. It was oddly hypnotic and I wondered how we looked to other people. Did we look like teachers or parents or older brothers and sisters? We drifted on for a while with no plan in mind and I told my girlfriend that we should see what he wanted to do. It will be good for him to make his own decisions, I said. And we passed a light-up interactive game in a section entitled Memory. He let go of our hands, dropped the comfort blanket dangling out of his mouth and ran over to prod the illuminated squares. My girlfriend and I stood back and watched him try to imitate a sequence. Maybe he's a genius, I said. He isn't autistic, she responded. And with that, I pulled her to me and kissed her. And for a moment, we were lost in each other's perfection, drunk on our own ingenuity and mad parenting skills. This was so easy, and we were so good at it. Our happiness was broken by a scream of terror. We looked over to where Jack had been and found him standing next to a girl of a similar age with a much larger build. She was clutching a fleshy hand to our eye and howling in pain. Jack was motionless, staring at the blood that dripped from between her fingers in total fascination, like she was another interactive exhibition ready to play with. We could see what had unfolded, and without a shadow of a doubt, I certainly got his violent temper from my girlfriend. After all, she was the one who threw a remote control at my head when I forgot her birthday. A crowd began to gather, a frantic mother pawing at her daughter in concern, a security guard urging the weeping girl to withdraw her hand from a bleeding eye, a man who insisted he was a doctor. Jack stood motionless, his mouth forming an O shape, and then he began to cry. It wasn't her turn to play, he wailed, as the doctor pressed something cold to the girl's eye. Jack turned to find us, his adopted parents, but we had gone.
Advice from that, don't swear at children, don't kidnap children, noted, thank you very much. That concludes part one. Please fill in your finish the lines and hand them to me or put them on the piano or something. Donations to the poverty stricken sound guy. You have 15 minutes to get beer, relieve yourself of beer, pen a small story if you're inspired. You have 15 minutes, people, use them well. Thank you. Going on. Real name Helen as A.A. habit, she's published two thrillers about murder and mayhem in big business. While she's writing her third book at the moment, she also writes short stories and belongs to the Bristol Fiction Writers Group, which meets at the Central Library. They're currently all writing crime stories so they can publish another anthology. So, round of applause for Alex.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm A.A. Abbott, a name you won't find on my birth certificate, but you will find it online, on Facebook and on Twitter. And this is Flash Fiction, so link and you'll miss it. It's called A Crystal Monopoly. Where did the dice go? Oh, I've rolled four. No, that's five, Gerald says. It's four, mate, Dan repeats. I've landed on Aztec West. I'm buying that. He has all the green properties now. He's going to win. I sigh. Pass the Jack Daniels, mate. Dan turned up earlier with Jack Daniels and a suitcase. We'll get the rent tomorrow, he says. Later, I'm dreaming of being marched out of Aztec West past a giant gum tree. Dan's sitting at the top, laughing. By morning, he's gone, with my MacBook and Jeremy's iPad. Guess I'm glad we didn't play Cluedo. Thanks very much. Thank you for that.
Always prefer Cluedo to Monopoly, anyway. So, last up is one of our very own Stokescroft writers. I did realise when I was writing her bio that I've known her for over 2 years and have no idea how to say her surname. So, we'll go with Mel Chiabuco. Mel is one of the founding members of Stokescroft Writer, is an incredible short story writer, has been published all over the place, and was long-listed for the prestigious Bristol Short Story Prize. She's reading Zombie on the Boat with the talented Mr. Christopher Fielden, who's also a Stokescroft writer. Hold on to your hat, people.
Right, those are really lovely stories, and we're going to really, really lower the tone, just for a warning. Okay, mid-mic. Am I in the mic enough? Okay. Right, Zombies on a Boat. To summarise today's class, some simple do's and don'ts. My tutor's arm wobbles as she writes her list on the board. A hair is the colour things go when they've accidentally had bleach spilt on them. She's wearing an orange dress over trousers just to add insult to injury. When the fuck am I doing this stupid writing course? Remember, she continues, keep those sentences short and snappy, and beware of clichés, stereotypes, and use your adjectives sparingly. Oh God, will this ever be over? It's only one day a week, but it feels like an eternity. I'm dying for a cigarette. Never ever start sentences with and, so, but, or because. She sets our homework to write a story on the theme of boats to be read aloud in next week's class. I'm definitely not showing up with that. 5 minutes later, I'm outside, eagerly sucking on a cigarette. I'll look forward to your masterpiece next week then, Ginger Minge says. I really shouldn't call her that. I can't bear the thought of her flapping fiery haven. Whatever. She stops next to me for a moment, clutching a messy pile of papers, her oversized handbag slipping off her shoulder. This isn't school, Zandy. You don't have to be here. Why don't you just stay at home next week, do the whole class a favour? We don't need people like you disrupting us. These people are intellectuals. They're not dropouts who sponge off their mum and dad. I don't have a dad, I interrupt. He's dead. I always love playing the guilt card. She rolls her eyes. I don't have time for this. She trudges away, chauntering something about how it's meant to be a centre for mature students, whilst fumbling for her car keys. I've no intention of wasting your time, I call to her. Maybe I'll write a story you'll just love. Don't bother, she says and slams her car door. I walk off grinning to myself as ideas for stories pour into my mind. Maybe I will show up next week after all.
Zombies on a boat. So, there's this little island called Rottnest in Western Australia, and there's some weird little animals that crap a lot called quokkas, which kind of look if a kangaroo had shagged a possum. There's a ferry which takes all the rich, stupid tourists to and from Rottnest Island. And one day an English family got on the ferry with their 10-year-old son. It was sunny, obviously. It's always bloody sunny in Australia. The crew were typical loud Aussies. All of a sudden, someone saw something brown and furry suddenly run across the floor under a chair, suddenly. The son, who had seen it, said, "Look, Mum, there's a quokka on the ferry." The mum nodded distantly, and then a crew person went to get a broom and tried to get it out from under the chair. The quokka suddenly leaped out and snarled at the crew member. There was crusty blood in its fur over its face. The quokka suddenly jumped on the man's face, gnawing at his nose, and everyone started screaming. The man's nose was barely hanging on by a thread of skin and blood was pouring everywhere. And he started shaking and grunting and his eyes bulged so much that eventually they popped out and hung like droopy testicles. Another crew member came along and said, "Aye, Bruce, good day, you all right, mate?" But Bruce lunged towards him and tore a chunk off his cheek and then ate it and then licked his lips, sucking up the blood dribbling down his chin and then burped. Then the other crew man started grunting because he too was turning into a zombie. And then he pounced on the dad of the family. "Wait, you can't kill me, I have a son!" It was a terrible voice to choose for the dad, sorry. He gurgled as the man dragged a bottle across his throat, and the dad's blood spilled everywhere, and the zombie started to eat the dad. The mum screamed, and the kid's eyes widened in the biggest amount of fear he had ever felt. The zombie cut open the dad's belly and started chewing on his intestines.
"My class, Alexandra," the ginger witch says, not even allowing me to finish it. A few people in the class look as if their pet cat has just presented them with a dead bird. "It's Zandy," I correct her. She looks as if her head might explode. "Get out." I grab my coat and my bag, my fucking pleasure. At home, my teenage brother Ben is using my laptop again. I glance at the screen expecting to see the usual array of tits and arses, but realise it's in fact my story he's reading. "Did I give you permission to read that?" "This is actually pretty funny," he says. "I think we should post it online." "It's just a stupid story," I shrug. "I only wrote it to piss off my tutor." "But there's this website where people read and comment and on stories, and people have gotten like famous from putting stuff on there." "Whatever," I say, padding down my pockets, feeling for my cigarettes. "I'm off. Do what you like. Nobody reads this shit on those websites anyway."
"Mummy, what's happening?" the kid cried. His mum just screamed and screamed as she watched the zombie eating mouthfuls of dad's intestines. The quokkas continued to attack people, and then those people attacked other people. The boat filling with guts and blood, and nobody could escape from the zombies because they were on a boat. "Mum, come on, let's hide," the son said. And they ran down the ferry away from the screams and the smell of blood and piss. The boy stopped dead. There was suddenly another quokka, and it was right in front of him, snarling. Mum screamed again, "Maybe if we stay really still, he won't see us and he will go on by." The quokka suddenly charged at the boy, ripping his head clean off his shoulders. The quokka smashed the head open on the table and eagerly ate the brains, as if he were a starving Ethiopian child. Another quokka suddenly appeared and they fought over the brains and eventually they just humped on top of the severed head instead. The mum was frozen in shock, watching the quokkas fuck each other and fuck her son's severed head, and then she vomited and the quokkas ate the vomit.
"Hey, Zand," Ben calls, sitting at the computer as I try to sneak past. "I need to lie down. Four pints at lunchtime is never a good idea." "What?" I groan. "You know that story I posted last week? Loads of people have been reading it." I peer towards the screen, trying to keep my distance from him so he doesn't smell beer on my breath. He'll only run off and tell Mum, and then she won't give me any more money. Ben scrolls down through a long list of comments. "Whoa," I say. "Never expected so many people to read it. Budge off for a minute, I need to check my emails." I log in and see an email from the Rottnest Island Authority. I skim through. "Seeing your work online, we object to the inaccurate portrayal of quokkas. Serious damage to tourism, blah, blah." I delete it, along with the other junk mail, and sign out.
Everyone on the boat was going crazy and screaming and all grossly bloody and screaming scarily and terrifyingly and lots of other words ending in lee, 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 lee. But there was one man who could save them. He was big and black and was on holiday from his work at the NYPD. He was a karate black belt and he punched and kicked and karate chopped all the zombies and all the zombie quackers, but they kept getting back up again because they were zombies, so they couldn't be killed. Then he said in his badass raspy voice, "Bring it on, you furry motherfuckers." The quokka zombies and the people zombies all attacked him at once, ripping his limbs off his body. A quokka jumped on his groin, tore a hole in his trousers and started eating his foreskin. Another quokka crawled inside the back of his trousers and started nibbling his bum. The man screamed a lot and then he stopped, because he was dead. And there was no hope for the rest of them, because the zombies kept eating. The mum watched sobbing, wondering how they would ever get out. Who could possibly save them now? And then I woke up.
Over the next week, I get several more emails from the Rottnest Island Authority. Please remove zombies on a boat immediately. Damaging to Rottnest tourism, will be forced to take legal action. I delete all of them. Then comes the final one. We are now taking legal action. I reply, saying, "This is ridiculous. You can't sue me over a piece of fiction. Fuck off." I rummage through my bag, looking for my cigarettes, telling myself, they can't do fuck all about it. It's just a stupid story, just a joke. I find my cigarettes and lean out of my window to smoke one, then douse the room with a liberal spray of deodorant. On my return, Mom is sitting at the kitchen table with a letter in front of her. She's going to start ranting at me about something, I can tell. "Who are the Rottnest Island Authority?" she asked. "I don't know." "What do you mean you don't know?" she says, flapping the letter around. "They're suing us for 50,000 Australian dollars. It looks as if a vein is about to explode in her forehead. "What? $50,000, she says. "Over some story you've posted online, apparently. What do you have to say for yourself?" The phone rings, saved by the bell. We both run for it, but I get there first. "Hello?" I nod and turn away from my mum's disapproving glare as I listen. "What? Really? Cool. Yeah, okay, count me in." I hang up. Mum stares at me with raised eyebrows. "Who is that?" I sit down silently at the table, my legs quivering in shock as I try to absorb the words I've just heard. "Stop being so melodramatic, Zandy," she says, sitting down next to me. "But I only wrote it as a joke," I stutter. "What?" Mum says. "Tell me. It's just some silly zombie story. I can't believe it." "Will you just tell me what this is all about?" Mum cries. "There was a film producer on the phone," I said, the words hardly sounding real. "They saw my story online and they want to make it into a film. They've got Samuel L. Jackson in mind. They want to pay me a lot of money. Probably a six-figure sum," I said, "to buy the rights." "My God," her jaw drops. "You better not be kidding me here." "No, seriously, I'm not." It feels as if my facial muscles have turned to custard. "Honestly?" Mum asks. "Yes, honestly." A grin spreads across her face. "They did specify one condition, though," I smile. "I have to write a sequel."
Zombies on a Boat Part 2. Attack of the Vampires. So it went dark and the humans were all dead and the zombies and quokkas ate what was left of the humans and there was guts and shit everywhere and the zombies love it and rolled around in it and the quokkas fucked in it. Then suddenly a vampire walked in with jet black hair and a sweepy fringe holding some hair straighteners. He had like fangs and like orangey coloured eyes and pale skin and all that crap. He looked at the zombies, all turned and gasped at exactly the same time and the quokkas even stopped fucking for a moment to look at him. The zombies all jumped on him and started to try and eat him, but he was like, "Duh, I'm undead, you can't eat me, you stupid lame zombies." He flicked his fringe and walked off to go and get his vampire mates, who also had sweepy fringes, but they hadn't heard any of the commotion because they had been busy straightening their hair. They all went to find a PA system to put their emo music on. The zombies hated it and hid at the other end of the ferry, and the quokkas hated it even more, and their brains exploded. The vampires had a human girl with them called Ella, and they took it in turns to have sex with her, and she loved it. Then suddenly a werewolf came along, but he was still in human form, but they knew he was a werewolf because his jeans were all ripped up and he had no t-shirt on and he was ridiculously muscly and tanned. "Oh, Drake," the slutty human girl said, and ran over to him and pulled down his jeans and started sucking his cock. The main vampire guy, Edwin, started fucking her in the ass at the same time, whilst Paramore played on the PA. But the zombies have now seen the girl and started trying to eat her, until Drake finally turned into a werewolf and ripped their heads off with his big teeth. But it was too late, because the girl had already been bit by a zombie, and so she started turning into a zombie. But Drake didn't realise she was turning into a zombie, and started trying to put his furry dog cock in her zombie mouth. Then she bit it off and spat it at Edwin, who was all stroppy because it messed up his hair. Then the werewolves killed the rest of the vampires and the zombies. Finally, they could do the one thing they had come to do in the first place. Turn off the awful music. The end.
Kind of highbrow literary stuff you can expect from Spexworth writers. Thank you very much, guys. So that is it for the performers tonight. Can I get a big round of applause for everyone? So the last section of the night is when we turn the tables on you. Thank you all for those who finished the lines. The wonderful Thomas David Parker is going to read out the best ones of the night.
Elizabeth Paul. Okay. I'm going to do these in order. We're going to do a bunch of number ones, a bunch of number twos, and a bunch of number threes. Okay, so... hey, everyone, for the number two. We're at that level now, thank you, Mel. Can't wait to see that movie. And the second on the Sci-Fi Channel. Janet was worried about her throbbing heart palpitations. He was just too damn gorgeous. You're welcome, Janet. Janet was worried about her throbbing labia. Can I just get a call out of who plays Cards Against Humanity in this crowd? Yeah. Didn't think I needed to ask, but that's fine. There is a theme. Janet was worried about her throbbing, pulsating, hot casserole it was going to blow. Janet was worried about her throbbing goldfish, which had fallen out of its bowl in an attempt to commit suicide earlier that day. Janet was worried about her throbbing, yet strangely stoic, guinea pig. Janet was worried about her throbbing aneurysm. It was causing aberrant signals in the synaptic nerve. Consequently, her thoughts and body movement were epileptic and garbled, respectively. Her pole vault event was surely in peril. Okay. So we're going to number twos now. Got it, thank you. He only had 6 minutes to live, but Clive had Jamie's 5 minute meals. Clive is going to be very disappointed. He only had 6 minutes to live, but Clive could not decide on which cheese he preferred to die eating. Don't know. He only had 6 minutes to live, but jolted in horror at the realisation he'd left the oven on. He only had 6 minutes to live, but Clive wished it was 4, so he could begin singing 4 Minute Warning by Mark Owen. And I think it's that lifestyle choice which is why he only has 6 minutes to live. Okay, on to threes. It's called the Left Bank because it's actually a bank that people enjoy sitting in and drinking, and the bank manager gave up trying to stop them. It's always... on your left, always in capital letters as well, which I came from town, so I feel that I'm someone's enemy now, so it's all. Okay, they call it the Left Bank because everyone has their own way of distancing themselves from UKIP. And this actually came in last, sopping wet, it has dried out now, but it's actually, it ties in all three, which is quite beautiful, so I thought it was a nice one to end on. So we have Janet was worried about a throbbing hand, which was aching and dripping with Clive's blood. He only had 6 minutes to live, but Clive spent them viciously punching Janet in the head. They call it the Left Bank because Janet and Clive made this their local. Their regulars honoured them after their retrieving their bodies from the left side of the River Avon.
Beautiful. Thank you very much, everyone.
Quite a lot of talent in the room. As I said, all our favourites will go up on the website, stokesgroffwriters.com, Chris. And if anyone takes any of those first lines, turns them into a story and performs them at any of the Talking Tales in the future, then we will buy you a drink, won't we? that's it. I want to say thank you again to everyone that performed tonight. It does take balls to get up here, so thank you very much. And we'd like to encourage anyone to submit for next time, which will be the Monday the 15th of June. And thank you all for coming, the first Talking Tales. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.